This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Michael P.V. Doe on the 21st of April, 2001, at approximately 4:15. We are at the International Cultural Center in Lubbock, Texas. Thank you very much, sir, for agreeing to this interview. I want to begin with a discussion of your early life, and I was wondering if you'd tell us when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for interviewing me. I was born in a small province in central Vietnam. My grandparent, who was a Mandarin in the Nguyen Dynasty, he's very high official. Mm-hmm. He was vice minister of foreign affairs and cultural and education ministry. But my father didn't do anything because he was born to a wealthy family and he enjoyed his life. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, in 1948, when the communists took power in central Vietnam, they kidnapped my father and brought him to the central Vietnam, put him in prison for 7 years. Until 1954, they released him, but killed him on the way back home. That's the main reason why, when I grow up, I would like to join the army. To do something, because I am at that time I am the only son to my mom, and according to the law that time, I do not have to be drafted, but I volunteer, and then I volunteered 3 times. The first time to the Air Force. At that time I was 17. And my mom complained, sent a letter to complain, and they had to send me home. The second time, I applied for the National Academy, Military Academy, that the biggest academy in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And once again, I was rejected because not enough time legally. And then I worked for. U.S. Embassy for 1 or 2 years, mm-hmm. working in counterterrorism program. And then when I got 18, I joined the Political Warfare College and was trained for 3 years to become second lieutenant. And after that, I was sent to 5th Infantry Division, mm-hmm. to be a vice commander. But I didn't see my future, as political warfare officer. So I sent a letter to get out of my branch, mm-hmm. to become a company commander. And I moved up, from that channel. And then I was wounded twice, and once very seriously. And was sent to the Air Force. Okay. In 1972, I was sent to the Air Force. There, I was the chief of political indoctrination office of the 2nd Air Division.
Okay.
And I became sick, and get out of the Army, the Air Force, in 1974. And then I complete my bachelor degree in political science. And when the communists took power in South Vietnam, they sent me to the prison camp for 10 years. Released in 1985, I worked whatever I could to make money. And 1990, I was saved by U.S. government in the HO program. HO, that means humanitarian orders. When Americans tried to get us out of Vietnam with the whole family, and in return, Americans promised to do some favor to the communists, and they let me go with the family. And I came to Austin in 1990 and worked and go to school, and I got my Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering in 1998. Mm-hmm. And recently, I graduated from National Technological Center with a master's degree in engineering management.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's quite a story. Were you born near Hue?
When?
Where?
Near
Hue? Was it near Hue?
Yeah, about 60 kilometers from Hue, north of Hue.
North of Hue? Right. Okay. And what year were you born, if you can tell me, if you don't mind telling me?
Quan 3. Quang.
Mm-hmm.
You miss G. G at the end, right?
T-R-I. Right. Okay. And how old were you when your father was killed?
I was 1.
As you grew up, did your mother and your other family members, the older family members in your family, talk to you about things like the Japanese occupation of Vietnam? And I'm sure you were taught about these things in school.
Oh, yeah. The story happened to my father, too.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, my uncle was, chief of police of the capital of Hue.
Mm-hmm.
And he saved my father, because the Japanese almost, chopped my father's head because he said something not favorable to the Japanese. And that I was told that Japanese, were our enemy too.
Mm-hmm. And was there very much discussion of the role that the Viet Minh did play in at least fighting the Japanese? Was that recognized and discussed when you were in school?
We understand that the Viet Minh initially was not communist movement.
Mm-hmm.
That, that the gathering of all nationalists, all the people who love the country, who fight for independence,
mm-hmm.
that includes the people in communist party, the nationalist party, that Kuomintang.
Mm-hmm.
But when Ho Chi Minh had power, he tried to eliminate the only opposing parties,
mm-hmm.
and they only stay the only communist party member. So the Viet Minh to us is a nationalist patriot, mm-hmm. okay? But later on, Ho Chi Minh, take advantage of the movement,
mm-hmm.
and created his party. If you recall, at that time, Ho Chi Minh did name his party Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
He disguised under the name Labour Party.
Yes. And did they talk to you much, and did you learn much early on in your life about President Ngo Dinh Diem?
Yeah, we learned from school.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And what? How did they? What did you learn about him, or in your early education?
About President Diem.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, in Vietnam, people pay respect to the leader, mm-hmm. right? So we learned very good thing about President Diem. And after President Diem was killed, people talk different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, after half of century, 25 years, when I look back, and I think that President Diem is really a good man.
Mm-hmm.
He is the man we need, except for one thing, because he come out from a Mandarin family.
Mm-hmm.
So he must have something characteristic, from the Mandarin family.
Mm-hmm.
That why, that not avoidable, because when you learn, you grow up in the that family,
mm-hmm.
you cannot change, over time, you cannot change in one day from a Mandarin, from a federalism, to become a democratic
mm-hmm.
people right away. So I know that President Diem have something people disagree, but that I accept it, because in the transition, we have to accept whatever, not quite, not perfect.
You came from a Mandarin background. Were you raised in terms of philosophy or religion as a Confucius and a Buddhist,
right.
or?
Mostly Confucius.
Okay.
And we try to maintain our morality, our social value, by paying respect to the people who have high value, high education, and have virtue, dignity. Okay, that's why, you know, when any change would be hard to us, I honestly, you know, confess that.
Did your philosophy change very much as you grew older?
Yes, very much.
How did it change?
It changed now is, you know, I accept, people are equal, okay? Mm-hmm. Even the guy from very low class, but he tried, he improved himself, he moved up to the upper class, that's okay. But he must improve himself first. The communists didn't do the same way. The communists, they don't go to school. They don't improve themselves. They get the power by the force, and they get to the higher position. That's the thing I don't accept. Because when they have the power, they don't know how to work and to make things work. Mm-hmm. But if you get, you know, through education and through improvement yourself, and you get to high power, you know how to work out, right? Like in America, okay, we accept, you know, like some people, you know, from, you know, when the child, he may be a beggar and, you know, wandering on the street, but he study and he work hard, he make money, and he have a strong mind to move up, and someday he can become president of the United States. It's okay, no problem. That got changed in my mind, philosophy. The second thing in my philosophy, as you see, I go through many, you know, years of suffering, but I still move up. When I came to United States, I was 45, and I start over again. I start school, and my friend, my family, and my relative, sister, aunt, they say, you're old. Now, try to work to feed your family first. You cannot study, and even if you study, you cannot get a job. I say, why not? I'm a man, human. Other people can do, so can't I? And I spent 7 years for my bachelor's degree. And I don't stop.
No, apparently not. Was it, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but while you're on the subject, when you were going to school here at first in the United States, was it hard for you to find work to go to school at the same time?
I work at night and go to school in daytime.
Okay.
That very, you know, I can consider, look back and say that a nightmare, because I didn't sleep for almost 7 years. Mm-hmm. I didn't sleep. Imagine that I work from 6 to 6, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And then from work, I go back to school. And I get into whatever corner, quiet corner, to take a short nap and go to another class. And go out for a while to take shower and eat something and then go back to work.
Wow.
7 years.
And you did it.
I did. I made it.
You, in your early life, and as you grew older and got closer to your to an age where you could enter the military, did you have any family influences, uncles, or anybody in where you lived that mentored you and helped you and talked to you?
Unfortunately, I don't have any uncles that close to me to teach me. But when you know, like family tradition. My grandparents have a PhD degree when he was 29. And most of my uncle had, you know, graduated from college. So that encouraged me to study. But, you know, nobody teach me how to love, you know, the army, to love military. But look like I was born to wear uniform.
Mm-hmm.
When I was about 12, you know, during my middle and high school, you know, I collect all the picture of the soldier from the airborne ranger, pilot, and I make the one, you know, all the picture display, you know. And I collect all the paper, magazine about the Army. And I told myself, okay, when I grow up, I would be an officer. At that time, I would like to be a Navy officer. Mm-hmm. But I end up infantry.
But you first tried to go into the Air Force.
Right, yes.
And did you want to fly?
Yes, I did.
Did you ever get to?
No. But when I I was transferred to the Air Force, even I was a political warfare officer, mm-hmm. I tried to go with them. I tried to fly with them, and I have about 117 hours on 837.
Oh.
And people teach me how to hold a stick, mm-hmm. you know, to fly back from the combat back to the airport, but they didn't let me land.
But you flew in combat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's so crazy thing.
Yes. When you turn 17 and you try to join the Air Force, was it there in the round Hue, or did you go someplace out of Saigon?
I had to go to Nha Trang.
Okay.
That academy, the Air Force Academy, and I passed all the physical examination. And were about to do the paperwork, sign up paperwork, and would be sent to the training center. Mm-hmm. And then my mom found out that, no, okay, I'm joining the Air Force.
Well, when do you remember the first time you encountered an American?
I was with American, I work, okay, go back to when I was 17. Okay. I applied for a job at the 5th Special Forces headquarters in Nha Trang as interpreter, a translator. But at that time, I didn't speak well. Mm-hmm. So the guy told me that, okay, your English is not good enough to be translator. Mm-hmm. So would you like to work as, in a warehouse? Drive a forklift, to move the case. And so I said, okay, yeah, okay. And then after a couple of months, I was sent to a BOQ in a compound near the beach, on Nha Trang Beach. Mm-hmm. And the guy there, I don't remember exactly his last name, but first name is Dunham. Mm-hmm. He's staff sergeant. And he let me stay inside the compound. And help me to control, some working people around there, and I try to learn English, more English. And when I come back to my hometown, Quang Tri, I apply for a job as translator, and at that time I worked for American Embassy, and daily I translate report daily, weekly, and I go with the advisor, to meet with the combat troop. Mm-hmm. And later on, I improve my English.
But what year was that when you worked for Special
65.
Forces?
1965.
Yeah,
and 66.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was that your first interaction with an American, or did you meet Americans before that?
That's the first interaction.
Okay. What did you think about Americans being in your country?
I think, I met some very nice guy. Uh-huh. Like my boss at that time, his name is Kenwood Foster. He's very nice, handsome, good-looking guy, very nice. And I don't have any bad idea about foreigner, because I know that they come to help us. At that time, we know it through the program like USAID. You had assistance for international development, something like that.
Sure.
And U.S. information system. Mm-hmm. U.S. Some operation mission, something. And I think, people are very, very, at that time, I learned, we are in free world. to fight against communism. And at that time, America is, you know, the leader of the free world. And then they help us. It's okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did, from your perspective, as a young man, 17 years old, what did you think was going on in your country? And what did you know was going on in your country in terms of the strife and the fighting between different groups of Vietnamese people?
What did you mean when young? Like
when you were 17.
And 17.
You know, but when the United States finally did enter your
okay.
country, what was it really going? What was really happening in Vietnam?
Really, I don't. At that time, I didn't like communism because what I know about communism only terrorism. They appear at night, kidnap people, kill people, chop the head, and put the body in the sandbag, in the rice bag. So what I know about communism at that time, and I witnessed. I was in a small district, and my house close to the market, and by the time close to the like the place where the district chief live, okay. And that night the communists attack the district area, and they shoot mortar into my house, killing two people who stay overnight in my house. At that time, I was in the basement, and my mom with me in the basement, and we survived. And the first time I saw the Viet Cong, that guy, you know, that guy at the gate of the district. Compound, and he wore the yellow khaki with the handkerchief cover his face, and we as a kid, five, 6 years old, I said, "Hey, come and see how the Vietnamese look like. He may have four ears, something like that, you know." And then when we lift up the handkerchief to see his face, oh, he like us, no different. But why he so cruel? Why the Vietnamese so cruel? Mm-hmm. Why they kill people? Mostly kill innocent people. Like, you know, they put a landmine along the road to kill the people who go to the market. The transportation at that time, the bus to carry the people to go to market. Mm-hmm. Only farmers. Why they kill those people? That's why, you know, I really hate communists from that time.
When did you first encounter Viet Cong? Or did you see them as the same, Viet Cong and Viet Minh?
At that time, we called them Viet Cong. We began to call them Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm. Right. Why did they kill people like that? Did you ever hear propaganda about that?
They kill people like that because, you know, like they want to carry out the terrorist act to scare people, to make people stay home, don't go to the market, or don't work for the government, like some nurse, teacher, they kill them. They say, don't teach for the government, don't work in hospital, okay? Like people who don't support them, they kill. They make them people scared and frustrated, don't know which side, you know, to go, don't know how to react.
Were you ever approached by Viet Cong to join them?
No.
No? And did you know Viet Cong that lived in your area?
When I was a kid, I have no idea about their whereabout. But when we moved to a city, we never even see them. But we benefit from their mortar every day. They shoot mortar every day into my district.
As you worked in the embassy, in the U.S. embassy, did you enjoy that work, translating
yes,
and interpreting?
Yes, I did. Very good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there a very large staff of Vietnamese interpreters and translators?
There are only two. two of us working with three American advisors mm-hmm. and a platoon of the Nung. You know the Nung people? Mm-hmm. They recruit the Nung because the Nung is very loyal.
Of course, that brings up the issue of ethnic minorities in Vietnam.
Right.
What did, from your perspective, how did the various groups within Vietnam get along? Not just religious groups, but ethnic groups.
Ethnic group, the group from North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We trust them. Mm. But ethnic group in central Vietnam, really we have too much differences between us. Mm-hmm. We are from the stream, from China, mm-hmm. South China, and we have a culture influenced by the Chinese. And the people in central Highland, they have influence from India. So different in culture, different religion, different in race. Mm-hmm. That's why it's hard for us, you know, to understand each other and to live together, you know, peacefully. Mm-hmm. But the Nung or the Mao, the tribe in North Vietnam is they are same race. Mm-hmm. We are same race, mm-hmm. and we have same influence, same culture. Mm-hmm. The people in central Vietnam have the culture, the same culture as the Thailand, mm-hmm. Cambodian, and Laos. And they don't like it. They hate us. Mm-hmm. That history, we destroyed two kingdoms in South Vietnam.
Yes. The Cham.
The Cham. Mm-hmm. And one more kingdom. What we call the east part of Cambodia mm-hmm. at that time a kingdom. Okay. And we destroy them, push them back to nowadays Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. What as you got older and became more involved politically in South Vietnam? What was the relationship, from your perspective, between South Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia?
Cambodia, at that time, they didn't like American and didn't like the communists either. Mm-hmm. They're in the situation to be neutral. But because they didn't like Vietnamese, so they have something, you know, they help the North Vietnamese. Even the North Vietnamese, when the North Vietnamese send troops, you know, to hide, you know, within their territory, they complain. But they could, you know, push them out. They have to accept the North Vietnamese troops in their land. Mm-hmm. But they hate both North and South. But at that time, you know, they you know, they couldn't do anything, you know, to prevent the North Vietnamese to move in. Mm-hmm. And for Laos, I believe Laos people is very good, very nice people. But that's very small, very small country. And for, you know, along our history, we have several times invade Laos, Cambodia, and we established, you know, a domination over Laos and Cambodia. But, you know, Laos would get more influence from North Vietnam because it's far from South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So, even after Lon Nol, right, mm-hmm. overthrew Sihanouk to become a republic, you know, to become our ally, we still did trust them. Because when we send, they killed Vietnamese people, 10,000 Vietnamese people. And at that time, 70 and 71. Mm-hmm. And when we invaded Cambodia, you know, we didn't trust their troops. Mm-hmm. They go with us, but, you know, we always, you know, far away from us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how long did you work for the U.S. Embassy?
I think about 1 year or more. Mm-hmm.
And then you went to the political warfare college.
Right, yes.
What was the emphasis of your instruction there?
We have two parts, one military to become an officer, a mm-hmm. platoon leader, mm-hmm. and the second part we study a broad range of discipline, like political, economy, social wealth, sociology, mm-hmm. anthropology, ethnology, oh, a bunch of them, mm-hmm. and law, mm-hmm. yeah, psychology.
Wow. Is this in the Dalat?
Right, yes.
Okay. Had you been to the Dalat before?
No.
What did you think of it when you got there?
It's a very beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with a young lady there, and I married her for 32 years now.
Wow. Okay. What did you find most challenging about your training in the Dalat?
Challenging. Well, okay, this is a very, very sad thing, okay. The political warfare system mm-hmm. was not favored by American advisors, because in American army there is no political warfare, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have any budget from American assistance. The only thing we can have that we have to incorporate the PX into political warfare system mm-hmm. to get the budget from the PS, US, you know, PS, the first thing. And second, we have psychological office. So that only two sections we get money from US. Mm-hmm. And mostly we rely on the training from Taiwan army, and they send officers, you know, to teach us about communism. Mm-hmm. But American maintain a colonel to be advisor, you know, to run, you know, somewhat supply. But really, he was not involved in our training program. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, the political warfare college in Dalat is very poor. Was very poor compared to the National Military Academy. Like a wealthy guy, yeah. Michael Dell over here, and Michael Doe over here.
Okay. The political aspect of your training, did it emphasize different political philosophies, or did it focus on democracy and republicanism? And what was the political
We learned everything, almost everything. Mm-hmm. We learned about history of all regimes in the world. We compare between the capitalism and communism, mm-hmm. and mostly we focus on communism. We learn a lot, you know, about communism. Mm-hmm. But honestly speaking, at that time I learned, but I didn't believe too much. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at that time I still think, oh, it's propaganda, okay? Because we fight against communism, so we have to say bad things about them. Mm-hmm. And we didn't believe that, you know, the communist is that kind of man, mm-hmm. who behaved like that way. Until I lived under communism, I realized that we didn't learn enough about them. Not enough. Mm-hmm. But at the time, we have freedom, you know, we fought them. We think we learned too much, okay, to exaggerate mm-hmm. from And later on, I think we should learn more about them.
Yes, sir.
And my conclusion, you know, about it is that, you know, people only understand communism and if they live under communism. You don't know about it. Mm-hmm. You cannot read the book. The book always says the good thing.
Did you read a lot of the original writings from Karl Marx and Lenin, mm-hmm, the translations
right,
of
yeah.
those works?
Yeah.
What did you take away from those that was important for you as you started to fight against communists?
Well, the first thing, you remember their song, okay? Get everything from their hand to our hand. Mm-hmm. You agree that argument? don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot fight Michael Dell to get his wealth, okay, to bring his money to your house. You work. The company do that way. They don't convince people to work hard to make money, to be wealthy,
mm-hmm.
but they convince people to fight against the wealthy people to get what they have. That's the thing I don't accept. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, they said that, we, like, what were we, it's hard to translate into English, but, you know, we work at our ability, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we enjoy, or we get as our need,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. You work hard, you get more. The people don't work hard, get less. That is the equality.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot work hard and I share, you know, the thing with the guy who don't want to work. That's why I don't accept communism.
Mm-hmm. Did you read much of the writings by Mao Zedong?
Yes, sir. And look like it, you know, he wrote a dozen or scores of books. But look like there are nothing new if you can condense in one book.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, like he collect all the paper, he send letter, he send, and he organized in this subject and he make a book.
Mm-hmm.
And then he use the same stuff, material, and reorganize, you know, under all the topic to make another book.
Mm-hmm.
And he have a dozen or 20 or 30 different books. But you waste your time to read the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
because you know they repeat it from here, there. They repeat the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing is that, you know, they want to create on earth a paradise where people will live equally, you know, equal and happy. But I don't know how you can carry out that. How? Because people are not all saints, are not all good guys. People, you know, in any society, there must be good guy, bad guy. And that created inequality.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot bring them, you know, equal in like this way. No.
Did you feel like the political warfare college prepared you for what you had to do later in your military career?
I think so. I think so, but at that time in the army, in you know, overall the Vietnamese army not prepared to accept the political system yet.
Mm-hmm.
They don't believe the political system work. And mostly, you know, like when I talk with my general, commanding general, you know, he said, "Oh, we don't need you. We need people to fight. We don't need people to talk." And we couldn't do anything. We don't have power. You can convince a guy if you have power on him.
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Mm-hmm.
You can give him something. You can give him promotion, give him money,
mm-hmm.
give him a leave,
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 days. But as political warfare officer, I didn't have that power. So how can I convince my people if I cannot give him whatever benefit him? That's the first thing. And the second thing, you know, before we graduate from the school, mostly the officer who didn't know to do anything, they sent to political office to work because they know that, you know, look like a trash can of the unit. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
A trash?
Mm-hmm.
A trash can. So the people, the bad guy, you know, who cannot fight, who cannot handle any other job,
mm-hmm.
okay, move him to political office.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come, and when we graduate and send to the unit, we look at those guys, oh, so I am like this guy? The guy who don't know anything? Who don't do anything, I am with him? And make us feel so sad about ourselves. But, you know, the thing improved, you know, slightly, you know, year by year it improved, but not as we expected.
When did you graduate from the Political Warfare College?
In May 1969.
69. So President Thieu was...
Right, under President Thieu. Mm-hmm. He focused on political officers so much.
What did you think of President Thieu?
Somewhat he's a good guy, and somewhat he's not good, because he covered up, you know, for his subordinate.
Okay.
He's a good guy. He loved his soldier. Every New Year, he flew, you know, to stay with the troop in outpost, and he very friendly with us. Okay, but the other hand, he trusts too much his friend and who he favors. And then, like I said in the seminar, the general assigned not because of his skill or virtue or dignity, but because of favor, you know, friend, favorite friend of President Thieu. And that created corruption system in Vietnam Army. Like some colonel, when he was regiment commander, he was accused of commit to corruption, and after, you know, the file, you know, go up to Congress to be investigated, he was promoted to general, one star, to a division commander. So that's why we feel very sad about President Thieu that way.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about some of the comments that have been made about the corruption in Vietnam and South Vietnam during the war?
Well, corruption is a common in any country, especially in the poor country. I don't have anything, and you put, you know, a mountain of money beside me without any control, and you expect me to stay in my place not stealing anything? An American mistake. Before American come, the living standard in Vietnam is moderate. Okay, we're not poor, we're not rich. But when American come, bring in, you know, luxury stuff. At that time, radio, cassette, you know, and whatever we never saw before. And then the people who work for American office, you know, make so much money. It made a big gap between our society, between the have-not. That created something, you know, which we long for. And when the American poor their material in Vietnam, you know, too much, too easy, without any control. And at that the same time, you know, the general, you know, assigned by the president was not a good guy. And he asked money from his subordinate. And in turn, that guy asked money from his below, and go down to company level. I am asked to pay $200,000 at that time. I don't know, but my pay is $15,000, and I am asked to pay $200,000 for my company to stay in a base, not go on operation. And the battalion commander told me, it's up to you. If you want to pay, I pay. If you don't want, we don't pay. And we decide not to pay. And we were sent to operation, you know, on around a year. And the guy, that time, the guy, the regiment commander, he was a colonel. And after that, he was promoted to province chief in Xuân Lộc. And after that, he promoted to 21st division commander. And the guy, that guy is now living in Houston. And the other example, like, you know, Shinon Tuan?
Mm-hmm. I've heard the name.
Right, you heard the name and you heard his story.
I haven't heard the complete story, I doubt.
He's a real bad guy. He has no skill. He's the guy always run. He cannot command a battalion, regiment, and division. But he moved up to corps commander. Mm-hmm. From second corps commander to third corps commander through corruption only.
How much do you think promotions, like with General Tuan and others, was dependent upon their loyalty to President Yu?
Right. Friendship.
They were friends.
Loyalty.
And they were loyal. And right. He could trust them.
Right.
They would always stand up for him.
Right. We know about dozens of good generals. General Nguyen Duc Thanh, mm-hmm. He was Minister of Development. General Hill, my former division commander. General Tang, 4th Corps commander. A dozen good guys. But they did stay long at their post. Because if they stay long, they can, you know, the other guy will look at them as an example and will feel danger for them and, you know, get rid of him first. That's why when General he was killed, we suspect somebody killed him. We know, but we don't have the proof. We don't have evidence. But we know that he was killed. Because at that time, General Hill's father was chairman of the anti-corruption committee. And General Hill is a very good guy. And he was killed in his office. And the guy who killed him got promotion. No, he's still at that post.
Oh. Don't tell. Don't say. Because I don't have evidence. I cannot say that.
Okay. Certainly. When you went from the Political Warfare College to your first unit in 1969, by that time, a lot had happened in the United States. Of 68, although a military victory for the South Vietnamese military and right. The United States military had become a political defeat
right.
In the mind of Americans.
Right.
And so Americans, the U.S. government had started to withdraw
right.
American forces. When you learned of that, what did you think and how did you feel?
Actually, at that time, I was in combat and I didn't pay much attention, you know, to the news. So, honestly speaking, I didn't know too much about the news because I didn't have time to think about it. But later on, after that, when I, you know, approached to the papers and, you know, radio and something and read the history, I had some anger.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, our fate, our destiny were not decided by ourselves, by someone else. And the war in Vietnam, you know, were decided in Washington. And even the communists, the North Vietnamese, you know, they announced that they didn't win the war in the battle, they win the war in Washington, D.C.
You heard that in 1968?
No, at that time, I didn't.
Okay. When did you hear that from the North?
After 75.
After 75. Okay.
In their books.
What did you... You were at the warfare college during TET of 68, correct?
At that time, yes.
What did you hear about TET and what happened in Dala?
At that time, I was in... I was on leave.
Okay.
At my hometown. And my hometown was not touched by the communists. But about 8 miles south of my hometown, mm-hmm. That a very, very big battle, the communists, that we killed about 3,000 or 4,000 communist troops.
Wow.
when they try to attack, you know, the OC Trail in that province. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know how to get there, and looked like they get very bad propaganda. Mm-hmm. Looked like when they moved to the south, you know, the officer told them that we already liberated the South Vietnam. No, you don't have to fight. You come there and enjoy, you know, the welcome from the South Vietnamese people. And when they move, you know, to the city, they have uniform, full dress uniform with medal, with, you know, and they prepare to be welcome, not to fight. That's true. And, you know, and let me remember. Look like in Anlop 1972, mm-hmm. the same way. When we kill them, they have a full uniform, full dress uniform with medal, you know, with everything. And the guy, a prisoner of the prisoner, we took prisoner, and we asked them, they say, I was told to come here to enjoy, you know, to enjoy the victory. Because the radio in Hanoi always, you know, say wrong thing about Vietnam. Like when they fight in a battle, you know, they announce that they destroyed the whole battalion or regiment. Mm-hmm. And they occupy the whole district or the whole province. And year by year, you know, they have to declare that they liberate the whole South Vietnam. And now you move into to occupy only, not to fight.
Did the people you captured in that type of circumstance, did they change sides? Did they say, I don't believe my government anymore? And did they want to fight with you against their government?
To the North Vietnam, North Vietnamese, no. Okay. Rarely. There are some, but you know, rarely, because they still have family back in North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And you know that the people who was born in that society, grow up and educated by that society, you cannot change his mind in 1 day or 2 day or 1 week or 2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But when even, excuse me, mm-hmm. but even they want to change, okay? Mm-hmm. You know that in the prison camp, in the POW camp, they have the system. They have the party system, the cell in the camp to control its people, everyone.
Okay.
And they could not show any feeling, you know, for not doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
At home.
Yes. Either during Tet or after Tet, did you hear about the massacre in Hue?
After.
How long after Tet?
Just not long after that, about 1 or 2 weeks, and people, you know, discover the site and remove the earth, the soil, and, you know, found out people tied to each other like this, very alive. All innocent people, mostly innocent people, with some professor from Germany. As we know, about more than 3,000. And a lot of people disappear. We don't know where about.
What did you hear in 1968? What, as you learned of this, what did you hear? Is it all of this, or did it come out? Is this also some more modern information?
Actually, at that time, we were back to our college.
Mm-hmm.
So we hear by our from our reality back in Hue,
mm-hmm.
a newspaper.
Okay, so unfortunately we have to end today, and thank you very much. This will end our first interview.